It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Over a century ago, Wisconsin's agriculture department said that farmers in this state were producing unprecedented yields, more oats than any other state, and enough wheat and rye to be completely self-sufficient.
Midwestern farms were thriving. World War I patriotism was surging, and this dynamic created a new relationship between farmers, the government, and the world.
A new book makes the case that Midwestern farmers were not bystanders to the rise of America as a world superpower, but a key to its ascent in the 1900s, transforming Wisconsin's farmland in the process.
Peter Simons is a historian and lecturer at Hamilton College in New York. His new book is called Global Heartland, Cultivating the American Century on the Midwestern Farm. Peter, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to talk with you today.
You take us through example after example of how Wisconsin and upper Midwest farmers like move away from isolationism toward globalization and the use of agriculture as part of these global relationships during and after the wars. Why is it important to highlight this chapter of American history?
It's important in part because there was this tension right at the beginning of World War II, where you find these two different camps, one mostly Americans who are living outside the Midwest, who are, I think, genuinely frightened that the Midwest is going to be the downfall of the United States as it begins fighting fascism overseas. And then you have this population of Midwesterners who are telling the opposite story, that they actually see the Midwest as being essential to whatever comes after World War II. And so there had long been this idea of Midwestern isolationism. And there's been a long-running feud about how genuine was that. And so you can trace that going back. And there's this surprising discovery that Midwesterners were actually much more engaged, and not even just engaged in creating this global world. They were, you know, they weren't just accepting what others were serving up, but they saw their work, particularly as farmers, as essential to building a world that came after. And so this question of why did they see themselves in this way was the genesis of this book, trying to answer how exactly did that come to be, and what does that mean about the way we understand the United States and its position in the world still today?
Still today, how does this lens on Midwestern farmers inform how we look at geopolitics now? What do you think?
I obviously had no expectation when I had begun writing this book that it would be published into the sort of global circumstances that we now find ourselves, that it's been published into. And so it is kind of an amazing thing, because the story talks about how the relationship between these farmers and the rest of the world becomes so essential to the work that they're doing that you really can't imagine anything else by the 1950s. And so to find ourselves in this world today where it's actually sort of reviving this mythology that Americans want to cut off their ties to the rest of the world. And of course, we've seen with current trade policy that there very quickly was a carve out made for farmers, because they do rely so heavily on the people who are eating American food abroad. It's obviously a bit different story now than it was in the 1940s and 1950s when I'm looking, but this thing had become so entrenched in American agriculture, and to at least ostensibly end that, you know, we'll see what actually ends up happening a year down the road, but is really reversing 60 or 70 years of American agricultural policy, American foreign policy, and really the fundamental sense of Americans and how they relate to the rest of the world.
And how Midwestern farmers were stepping up. I was astounded. Wisconsin's agricultural production skyrocketed in 1918 after the Great War, with Wisconsin producing the most oats in the nation, more corn than it had ever grown, enough wheat and rye to make the state self-sustaining. I just paused there, and I'm just wondering what increased our state's output this much?
There are a number of different factors But the most basic one is that it turned out to be incredibly profitable during the war because there was an incredible demand for these products. And so farmers would divert other crops into these that were most needed overseas and start growing more than they ever had before. But the other thing that happens is agricultural technology, like tractors, had been in development for quite some time leading up until World War I. But with the sudden loss of farmhands, family members, whoever, who was going either to fight abroad or they were going to factories to make the weapons that were going to be used abroad, there's a shortfall in agricultural labor. And so the very rapid adoption of these technologies helped create higher yields than states like Wisconsin had ever seen before. Of course, because they're building tanks and all trucks and all these other things that they need for war, there's not enough material to actually build all the tractors that are needed. So the state agricultural departments will send out bulletins telling you how to try to craft your own tractor or create your own plow that will hold you over until the war is done and you can actually buy proper equipment for your field. So this is a moment where we see a really intensified adoption of agricultural technology.
Peter, you trace the Lend-Lease Act. In 1941, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt formalized aid to Britain months before America formally enters World War II through the Lend-Lease Act. What was the Lend-Lease Act, and how did it lead to growth in America's agricultural exports?
The way that we usually understand Lend-Lease is through arming America's allies overseas. So sending airplanes, sending weapons to most notably Great Britain. The idea being that if we can give them the material that they need to fight the war against Germany, maybe the United States won't have to send their own troops, that this will sort of hold the Germans at bay and they'll win the war eventually. But what was interesting to me is the announcement of the Lend-Lease Act is in part made at a Farm Bureau Federation meeting in Washington, D.C. Lord Lothian, who's the British ambassador to the United States, is there as part of this announcement. He tragically dies the next day, but it goes to show that agriculture was foremost in the minds of Roosevelt and his cabinet as they were crafting the Lend-Lease Act. All of these other wartime materials were essential, but you couldn't have the war without all of this food. And so what it does is it immediately pulls American farmers into the war far before factories start filling with people who are building bombers and munitions and all these other things. And of course, the farmers don't have any choice because it's just sort of built into the market. The government is buying their farm products. They're not setting aside anything specially. And so the farmers are, in a way, the first American contributors to World War II. They're very skeptical at first because there is a sharp memory of World War I, and there's common knowledge that you have a recession after every war. And so war, for obvious reasons, you don't want a war, but especially for economic reasons, you don't want a war. But as Lend-Lease continues to go, farmers are starting to notice that they're enjoying better rates of return on their crops than they ever had in recent history, that there's suddenly a sustained market that they hadn't known since the 19-teens. And they're starting to see the benefit of supplying overseas consumers, even if it might be in wartime, that they're, that trade is becoming ever more essential to their own livelihood.
Mm-hmm. Dairy farmers in particular were skeptical, and dairy was labeled a victory food by Wisconsin dairy leaders during World War I. What was happening in dairy?
This is a turning point for dairy in the United States. Nutritional science is very new at this point, and so there's a greater understanding that there's a full gamut of nutrients that milk offers that many other foods don't. And so this becomes, in part, a marketing scheme, but also realization that people who desperately need food can really benefit from having milk. Of course, there's a geographical boundary on how far you can take a canister of milk. And so that had always limited dairy sheds if you are in Wisconsin, you're probably not sending your milk to New York, but you are to Chicago, maybe to Minneapolis. There are these new technologies. Once again, technology becomes key here to, for example, dry milk so that it can be sent abroad without the water. It's reconstituted and then can be consumed as milk overseas. With these technologies, which the federal government builds and then allows companies like Kraft to operate, allows for this explosion in the quantities of milk that can be shipped over much greater distances than they ever could before. And then at the end of the war, the federal government sells these facilities to these companies for usually a dollar, and they have these enormous new facilities that they can use to continue selling Midwestern dairy goods to consumers who had never been able to get them before.
We're talking about a new book exploring the power of Midwestern farming in World War II and beyond with Peter Simons, historian and author of Global Heartland. Peter, at the end of World War II, Wisconsin counted nearly 9,000 fewer farms between 1940 and 45. And you conclude that the Midwest agricultural countryside emerges from the war with fewer people who live on bigger farms and produce more food. And I'm wondering, how does that compare to our rural areas now and how our farming communities in Wisconsin are becoming larger and larger with these, you know, mechanized farms? Is this a continuation of what was happening in those times?
Yeah, it is a continuation of the intensification of agriculture. Part of what happens in the war is that there is a draft. And although the military draft is very lenient for farmers, mostly because they have a lot of friends in Congress, a growing number of farmhands, sons, daughters, go off to serve in the military. Others move to cities to much better pay than they had before. And if you read small town newspapers, agricultural newspapers, there will be this lament about the loss of all of these people who had grown up on farms and a despair whether they're going to come back again. So there's this focus on, we need to build a new hospital. We need to build an airport. We need all of these modern conveniences to attract these people who had been on farms back. Well, of course, they mostly don't come back. Part of the GI plan is that you could go to college or you could get a farm. And initially, the USDA is concerned that so many people are going to want their own farm when they come back from fighting overseas. And that just doesn't turn out to be the case. Very few people actually want to use government programs to purchase farms. People are much happier being elsewhere. And so by necessity, to continue producing the amount of food that is being demanded, the people who are left buy up these farms that are left. They, of course, have access to greater amounts of machinery. And so a single farmer can produce far more than they ever can. And this just continues on and on. And of course, following World War II, then we have a further chemical revolution. We have hybrid seeds that had been available but become intensified as well. So there are all these inputs that change and make it possible to produce food with far fewer people than ever before.
Women farmers also were increasing as well. Besides the farm machinery, you also saw women on the farm and their labor and responsibilities, especially during World War II. Can you describe what you were seeing there?
The role of women on farms is a hotly debated one at the time. And it even maps geographically that there are particular parts of the country where there's enormous resistance to welcoming women. I should make a distinction here. There's an acceptance of women who live on farms. So what the USDA would identify as farm wives, which is a tricky term, right? Because the women are just as much farmers, but they're never actually identified as farmers. They're identified as farm wives or their daughters. And so there's this sense of sort of a natural born instinct and what it takes to understand the land, to understand livestock. And so farmers are willing to give greater responsibility to women who are already on farms. But there are all of these other programs, for example, the Women's Land Army, that will recruit women who mostly live in urban places. Many of them are college students. They will spend the summer on a farm and then go back to school once the term starts in fall. And there's an enormous amount of resistance initially to this. Eventually, because the need is so desperate, there's increased acceptance. But there's certainly a very gendered notion of what's appropriate for a woman to do on a farm, because the farmers are much more willing to accept male farmers from outside the United States, for example, than they are women who are coming from a college campus to spend, say, 2 months on their farm. There's always skepticism of the relationship that they have to agriculture.
Let's land on tariffs, because the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act from 1930 leaps from your pages now, considering sure. The times we're in. I mean, modern debates around tariffs seem to really echo, it seems, arguments made, you know, about a century ago around issues like protecting domestic production. So what lessons can we learn from the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act that might be relevant to American farming today?
There is an intense debate between Henry Wallace, who then is Secretary of Agriculture, and someone named George Peek, who's often also in the USDA, about the best path forward for American agriculture. Is this something in which we benefit by engaging the rest of the world, or do we need to focus on the United States instead? There's the American Dairy Association has no interest in the 1940s in prolonging the shipments of dairy overseas. They just want to convince Americans that they should consume more dairy than they do right now. So they look to Scandinavia in particular, and they say, look at how much milk Scandinavians drink and look how much cheese they eat. We need to convince Americans to do the same. Well, obviously, this turns out to be a non-starter because American goods continue to go overseas. Now, the American farm economy is, of course, one in which there is an incredible amount of intervention to make American farming operate the way it does today. So I don't want to make any sort of pitch for some sort of mythological version of a market that without barriers that benefits American farmers. But at least I can say that in the past, it has proven that finding overseas markets has been one of the prime drivers of benefits to American farmers.
Peter, thank you for your book. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was lovely to speak with you.
That is historian Peter Simons, author of the new book, Global Heartland, Cultivating the American Century on the Midwestern Farm.